Welcome to Crosstalk. I am coming to you virtually with Dr. Rob Kelly, who is in San Antonio, Texas. I am so excited for you to meet Dr. Rob. If you haven't already seen his work, he's an incredible addiction specialist. He's called the addiction doctor. He's known all over the U.S. People fly to him from all over the world. He's written this great book. More importantly, he does these incredible conventions, the Neuro Project, the Neuro Hero Project, as well as he'll be performing in London with Tony Robbins. And we will, you know, put a link to that in the show notes and everything. So I'm really excited. Welcome, Dr. Rob.
Thank you so much, indeed. Great to be here, guys. Sit down. This is going to be a good one.
I'm so excited. So just, you know, a little briefing, what we do on Crosstalk is we want to hear all about your story. You have such an incredible story. I happen to be blessed and know it and have heard you speak for 2 days straight. It was one of the best weekends of my life. And, you know, I'm so excited to have you because your story is so incredible. So, you know, it's just kind of experience, strength, and hope. How did it start? Where did it go? What happened? And, you know, did they force you to get help? Did you choose your help? Whatever it looked like. And then what does it look like? You know, what did it look like in early recovery? What does it look like today? And then just, I'd love for you to go on a bit about, you know, all the amazing work you do. It's just, it's so incredible. I know you do some great deal of work. So I'm excited to hear all about it.
Thank you so much. And jump in anytime you want if you have questions. So guys, my name is Dr. Rob. I specialize in addiction, childhood trauma, depression, PTSD, and alcoholism, which we'll get into. It's different from drug addiction. We'll get into that. So we're kind of the leading researchers pertaining to neuroscience and anything to do with psych. We've been studying. I've wrote papers for Harvard University's psych hospital, which is McLeod Hospital, as well as other hospital and universities around. TV books, all that stuff out there. I took my first drink at the age of 9 on stage with my musical family. So not knowing nothing about alcoholism back in those days. But yeah, I played the first half, 9 years old, had the big bass guitar strapped round. My auntie was singing and my uncle played the lead guitar. So I was so nervous. He gave me a beer and he said, drink this, you'll feel great. And as I drank it, the whole world just changed right there for me. Now, when I go back and I ask other kids, you know, hey, when did you first drink? Oh, 9 and 10. What was it like? Oh, it was awful. Not for me. Then you come across the alcoholic. Well, it was like, oh, it was amazing. There was something happened. I didn't know then, but obviously I know today exactly what happened. But the drinking became, we played every Friday, Saturday and Sunday around the bars and clubs back in England, Manchester, around that 25 mile radius. I was the richest kid in our school. But I did grow up on the projects and we grew up very poor. So this was an extra income for me that nobody'd ever done before. It's like, well, when I leave school, obviously I go to college. If I'm lucky, then I'll get a job. But I always kept this throughout all of that. I kept it because we got paid good money. And especially when I went into the studio and, you know, played with like Elton John, Bowie, Queen, all them great guys at Abbey Road. They paid like, I don't know, I can't remember. I want to say it was like $250 an hour, which is probably about $5,000 today, maybe. I don't know. I mean, my memory's terrible, but I always did it. And as I went through school, I drank weekend, you know, like one half a beer or something. It was nothing, but it was enough to get me through and change my lonely personality to something amazing. I mean, you think it was Chuck Berry on stage with a bass guitar the way I was going, and everybody loved it. This little kid, you know, playing guitar, went through school normally, specialized in music and biology for some unknown reason, human biology I excelled in. But yeah, lower class school. Now, there was an occasion where I was about 15, 16, something like that, when a friend of mine from the posh estates, they happened to come to our school. His dad was a Freemason. Now, back in England, Freemasons different from over here. It's so secretive and so powerful that people like me don't get. You've got to be rich, famous, or, you know, I don't know, six-figure guy back in the day. But they were struggling for an organist, and I can play any instrument. It's just something I can do. It's, you know, I don't have to learn anything. Give it me for 10 minutes, I'll play it. And I have to say, that's the only thing I can do. I can't paint walls or fix cars. I don't do any of that. So that they invited me in. They were absolutely desperate for this 25th anniversary or something. They invited me in. But to get into the organ inside the lodge, you would have to be a position of outer guard before you're allowed to go in. So that was about 3 weeks I've done that. And then I prepped for that 25th anniversary or 100 year, I don't know what it was. But because of that, I actually became a Freemason very early age. So about 16 when I became. That's how I got in college. So don't anybody to think I got in college because I was clever or nah. The likes of me were never meant to be in them hallways on them halls.
That's how you got into Oxford. It's funny because I had a boyfriend who once got into my father's office and said, you know, I think your dad was a Freemason. And I said, what are you talking about? And he goes, I just see the symbol. There's all this stuff in his office. And I had no idea what that is. What an interesting world. So that's how you got into Oxford.
Yeah, that's how I got into Oxford and a few other things that I aspired. But, you know, when I got into the lodge, all these guys that you feared growing up, you know, these millionaires, these senior police officers, all that were in there. And I don't know why to this day, but they took a liking to this poor kid who was talented when it comes to music. That's how I got to Oxford, went there, you know, still drinking weekends, and it turned into during the week with, finally found somebody who could drink like me. These college kids were like, you know, until the work started and they'd leave at 9 to study or homework. And I was like, no need to do that, guys. Stay with me till 12. We'll bang some beers, then we'll bang some cocaine or speed, and then we'll stay up all night and we'll cram for, no, it wasn't their style, you know. So, but that's when the imposter syndrome first started, because it's carried on all of my life. Despite my trauma work, which is the gateway drug, childhood trauma. But my first time I sat down full uniform in the hall, the dining hall, and there was five forks, five spoons, five knives, and I was horrified because I had no idea. I thought we were just going to eat five chives or something, five, you know, iron chips. I don't know, you know. And it was at an early age I realized that if you copy people and let them go first, you can get away with a lot of stuff. And that's what I did. You know, I would never eat first until I knew exactly what was going on. And of course, from the outside in, as the different food came over, different courses. But then I got out of hand, my drinking every day. I scraped through, like literally scraped through. My first job was a police officer because all of the lodge were police officers. So it's just a case of me automatically just, you know, going in there. But I didn't last long, got fired for being drunk. Which my family were horrified about me being fired. I was horrified that they called me an alcoholic. How dare they? Yeah, I was just I was like, on the way home. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you called me an alcoholic. And then I have the alcoholic mind.
So at this stage, are you just alcohol still at this stage? Or were you ever any drugs or just alcohol?
You know, I took drugs. There's no doubt about it. I definitely, but it didn't do anything for me. That's the thing. It did nothing for me. So I can take drugs now. I took painkillers the other day for my surgery. They don't do anything for me. If I need you for pain, I'll take it. Like they gave me they gave me 10 pills to take. I've taken two and now I'm fine. So I don't need Cetirizine. Right. So it's purely alcohol. That confused me. And I thought it was all one and it isn't. So you can get guys who can't drink, but you can get down and take pain medicine. I mean, obviously if you get addictive personality, alcoholics are born, drug addicts are made, then you get hooked on it, then obviously you're done for. They both present the same, but no, it was purely alcohol for me. And
I'm going to ask you to speak further on the alcoholics are born and drug addicts are made. So I'm not sure if you want to do that now or kind of after we hear your incredible story. So that's my like number one question that I love the way you explain it. And I find it so interesting because it's really not about what we learn in treatment centers, especially even mine, which, you know, they teach you that addiction is addiction.
Yeah, they do, and they don't know anything else. They don't. I mean, we're kind of the leading authority in neuroscience pertaining to any psych problem. So we used to do 95% addiction, 5% trauma and entrepreneurs. Now we do 95% entrepreneurs, cure with PTSD, depression, and 5% alcohol and drugs, which is weird. The more we found out about neuroscience, the more we delved into the brain. And pertaining especially to addiction and rewiring of the brain, the more we realize that we can treat an array of patients with this rather than just alcohol and drugs. So if I say, guys, that alcohol has 1% to do with alcoholism, and the same with drugs, it's not the problem. It never was the problem. The problem was, is this. So alcoholics are born. Let's look at that first of all. Alcoholics are born with what's called a predisposition. It's the only illness you can pass down through family generation. Now, as soon as I say that, people go, "What? You can pass down heart problems. You can pass down." Bear with me, okay? So we have the predisposition, and we're allergic to the ethanol in alcohol. And three parts of the brain differ in the alcoholic from birth than any other brain in the world. And they are the hypothalamus, the basal ganglia, and the amygdala. The hypothalamus is there just to tell you blatantly to the prefrontal cortex to tell him blatantly you have to eat food, drink water to survive. That is it. If you don't, you will die. That is it. So we don't have to be taught to do that. Babies are born, hand down the mouth or crying when they're hungry. It's just a fundamental basic survival part of the brain. Boom. Okay. In alcoholics, not drug addicts. In alcoholics, the hypothalamus at that certain point of drinking career, we don't know when that is, automatically turns around and tells the alcoholic to drink alcohol only to survive. That's why I could go days or weeks without food or water. But a primary part of my survival brain is telling me I have to drink alcohol to survive. That's why everything else becomes second nature. So that's why, that's one of the reasons why it's a disease, because you don't have any control over that. Where the drug addicts, 95% of people that come to us with a heroin addiction started in the doctor's office. That speaks volume. So what we found with our research is that drug addicts will take a drug and they have the addictive personality. Very smart people, very, very smart people, but they get hooked, and that picks up the basal ganglia, which is kind of our repetition strength and confirms part of the brain, and it holds on to that. And they can't stop. So they both show up the same. But that's the difference between the two. And it's really important that we know that, because for years and years, we thought, hey, especially in AA, if you're taking drugs, you can't come in here. And everyone says, still, it's our drug, da, 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 and we accepted that. But no, because in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, they did have a version from the doctor that says alcoholic addict, doctor, alcoholic addict. So they kind of wanted to put the both together, but as the neuroscience and the years went on, it's just different. And you can argue that all
Got
you
it.
want, but we have the real science behind that.
That's so interesting. I find that incredible, and it makes total
Oh,
sense.
sorry. So let me get back to, it's the only illness you can pass down, alcoholism. People think, dad had heart problems, so eventually I get heart problems, so it's been passed down, it's a family illness. No such thing. It's biologically impossible to do that. But here's what happens. You have a staple food at home. Ours was chips and pie. We usually ate that most weeks, most days, actually. So what happens is with the genetic setup of father, there's a certain protein or food that he can't methylate during that diet. He never knows this by then. You don't know this. So let's say something in his dietary stuff he can't methylate. When you can't methylate a certain protein or food, there becomes a deficiency, okay? When there's a deficiency, there's an illness. So I'm on staple with dad. I'm at the staple food at home, but I have the same genetic almost setup, mom and dad, usually dad if I'm a boy. So when I leave the house, I kind of stick to that staple diet because that's what I'm used to eating. Fish on Friday, da 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 da. And I become a deficiency, same as dad. So then I have heart problems, and I think I've caught it from my dad. It's not true.
Very
And
interesting.
the more we find out, the more we We work at a very high level. We're like the SAS. There's like 15 of us all together, and we're on the world stage. You know, as what we do. You know, what we do is we work with it. So we split out. We split this up, and it's really important. I tell you this. So we work with all the A-list. We work with the government. We work with you know, high class musicians, footballers, actors, movie stars. That's where most of my work is done. But 25% of our work is pro bono. Everybody in my company must carry a free pro bono. Otherwise, you don't work for me. So we make sure we give back, because the kids like me, I couldn't afford anything like this. So, you know, we do that 25% to give back. Me and my wife give about $150,000 a year back into communities that need it, you know, for all sorts of reasons, but mainly, and I love doing this, the dad comes to us, you know, he's lost his kids, his wife's left, but he's got a date in court where it's a possibility he can fight for his children once a week, like say a Saturday. We'll pay for an apartment for 12 months. We'll buy him a suit. We'll get him Ubers there. We'll pay for his legal fees. Then we'll make sure that guy gets his kid once a week. That's why we do this stuff. You know, I could work. I don't have to worry about money ever again in my life, you know. And that's one of the reasons we started the Rob Kenny Foundation is I'm in a position now where I have what a lot of people don't have. And that is enough. I have enough.
Yeah.
Of everything. I have enough. Enough already. So we want to give back as much as possible. So when that's scared,
we feel the same way. We are a not-for-profit. Corey and I and Sergio, we don't make a thing off this. If anything, it all comes out of our pockets. And we've just started to get our first donation. So it's all to help people, you know. And I love that you do that. That's part of the reason I heard you say that, you know, I was scholarshiped to my treatment center. I didn't have that. I wouldn't have had that opportunity. Yeah.
No, it's important that we do that. I've been in the industry on and off for about 25, 30 years. I've been in America for 19 years, and over here, it's been full blast over here. And today, it's about helping people and giving back. Helping people and giving back. That's what it's about. We have a sliding scale. We just trying to make... I mean, I've worked with about 8,600 and some patients over the years. I've worked with telehealth and TV and radio, millions of people around the world have helped. So I know I'm doing the right thing, because spectacular things happened to me and have been for the last 5 or 6 years. When I truly found who I was, when I truly cleared all the childhood trauma and do not get involved in any trauma today, when I did that, I 100% found myself. And that was amazing. Absolutely mind-blowing to me.
Oh, I love hearing that. So let's continue with your story.
So I get through college. I started my first job as a police officer. I got fired from there. And then I got a little job at it was a company that was building towers for the army and the navy throughout England. So I was on the telephones. I was, you know, taking messages and stuff. And you have to understand that the alcoholic brain and the addicted brain are absolute geniuses. When they put their mind to something, they clear themselves. So they were building, you know, these big masts. So I was there for about 4 months. I'm like, I could do this. So I took one contract from them and I started my little business. Then 12 months later, we're doing over a million. And we're talking back in the 80s, 84, 85, 86, around that, I'm not sure. I started to become wealthy, and that was the worst thing that happened to me, because it masked my alcoholism. Like, what are you moaning about? You got the big house, you got cars in it, you can buy anything you want. I provide for this family. You know, my wife's like, please don't drink me. I provide. And it did mask for a long time, and still, obviously, if you're a real alcoholic, the one that has the three parts of the brain and born this way, there are loads of people who think they're alcoholics, but they're really heavy drinkers and abuse alcohol. In that case, just stop being a dick. But the one who's got the actual illness, you know, it's impossible to stop a part of that deal. But before I did, I built, you know, a mini empire, and I got married, a nice little house on the hill. I had the Mercedes, you know, shared Mercedes, and you know, I bought the Rolex watch, and it's all sort of, I could get rich, it would solve all my problems. Oh my God, how not true is that? But I didn't know at the time.
Right.
But I did drinking out of control, and eventually, I remember a lot of things happening that was out of control. But I used to leave my kids at the cinema while Dad went 5 miles to drive to a liquor store, and he's 1 and 3, and just tots, and I'd, you know, come back and the police were there. We're going to charge with neglect. One morning I came down, and it's early hours of the morning, and I had work in about 3 hours, but I wanted to drink. Now, again, going back to the hypothalamus, when I want to drink, I want to drink. Somebody said once, if I had a drink and put it behind my back, what would you do? And I said, literally, I'd stab you in the face repeatedly until you gave me the vodka. And he was like, aghast. I asked another alcoholic the same thing. He go, oh, yeah, so would I. It's like, that's why you need to understand where we're coming from. But I came down, and I knew I had vodka somewhere. I found it. I put it on the counter in the kitchen for a second. I turned around to get a crystal glass. Because, hey, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not drinking out the bottle. These are the things that the trick your mind plays with you. So I turned around to get the glass. And when I turned around, my wife was there, and she snatched the bottle up the side of the counter. And she said, Rob, I think you've had enough. Now, what I should have said was, thank you, Mrs. Kelly. You're right. I have work in a couple of hours. Go back to bed. What this alcoholic did was took a kitchen knife out and stabbed her 3 times. That's not natural, but it was for me. That's alcoholism, not heavy drinking or pure alcoholism. That was the only way my brain was telling me I could survive, to get that at all cost. So after she went down, she was bleeding, obviously. I call a taxi around the corner, and when a taxi come up, I call the police and the ambulance. And when I heard the sirens in the background, I jumped in the taxi and flew to the airport and fled to Spain. And it was there for 3 months because there wasn't an attempted murder charge out for me. So I couldn't come back. And then eventually, after 3 or 4 months, it was all sorted. Charges were dropped because my wife didn't want to press charges in the end. Over the UK, that's what it's like. If the person wants to, if you don't die, that is, don't want to press charges, nothing the police can do. And I came back. But when I got home, it was all waiting for me. And my wife had her bags packed at the front door, and my two little babies, ages 1 and 3-ish, again, can't really recall. And she says, I remember the next 20 minutes, 30 minutes. She said, I love you till the day I die. And you're not going to kill my kids. Then she left. Well, the next day I got my children back by court order. I got my attorney to go around there. She didn't have attorneys. And they got my kids back the next day, and he brought them around. I gave him a big check. I brought them in, and the sense of, you can't mess with me. You have no idea how much power I have. I sat in front of the TV. I'm 3 or 4 days sober by now. I sat in front of the TV. I went into the kitchen, and the thought out of the blue came, wouldn't it be great if I just had one beer to celebrate my kids coming back? 2 or 3 days later, when the police kicked the door down, there was vodka bottles strewn all over the floor. My two little babies had not been fed for a couple of days or changed diapers. The police got them and hitched me away, and served me with unfit father papers. Child service were there, child protection service were there, the police were there, she was there, mother-in-law was there. And they took my kids and they walked to the front door, and they gave my youngest one to my mother-in-law and my eldest one, Charlie, to mom. And the feeling was like no other human feeling I've ever felt in my life, because my heart was being tore out in front of me. One of the police officers was crying. And my daughter said three things to me. And this was 30 years ago, maybe. She said, Daddy, Daddy, please don't go. She's walking down the path holding Mommy's hand. And she got halfway down the path and she turned around and she said, Daddy, Daddy, please get better. And as they got to the gate and opened the gate, she turned around one more time. And she said, Daddy, Daddy, please stop drinking. And I couldn't do it. I went back into the kitchen. I opened another bottle of vodka. And 4 weeks later, 3 weeks, I don't know, I've lost the house. I've lost the holiday homes, the cars, my medical business. I've lost my children, my wife. My parents won't speak to me. My brother and sister disowned me. And I was living on the streets. And it happened quickly. Because remember the first night, pouring down with rain, freezing cold. I had a little coat on, holding a can of beer. And I just thought to myself, where the hell did that go? And that was me abandoned on the streets. Nobody wanted to know.
Wow. From like millionaire vacation homes, the whole nine, to homeless. Yep.
Yeah.
Wow.
I did a lot of stuff on the streets. I wasn't proud of to survive. You know, I beat people up coming out of nightclubs when they were drunk and steal a wallet. If I couldn't do that, I stole alcohol and threatened the security guards that I would kill them with this bottle if I didn't. And I stayed on there and, you know, seven suicide attempts, and on two occasions I died. I was dead on two occasions on the streets of Manchester, and they brought me back to life again. And I hated them, man, for that. I literally hated them because I couldn't live. That book tells you, well, I couldn't live with alcohol, I couldn't live without it. I often tell people, you know, I didn't actually go to hell because I survived it. But you know something, I could sure see from where I was. That's for sure. You know? And that was my life. I knew that I was never going out the streets. A little part of me thought I would. Because 97% of people in Manchester Piccadilly Gardens in England die on the streets. They die of overdose. They die of being beaten. They die of cold, of frozen. 3 or 4% get off the streets. And I was one of those 3 or 4%. So when people say to me today, why do you take risks in business? My answer is not one that they expect. They expect me to say, well, the clinical decision did it. I just say this to them. I died twice on the streets in Manchester. What are you going to do to me that I haven't already done to myself? What? I signed an office deal in Dallas 4 years ago for $1 million. My friend says to me, how do you sleep at night? What are they going to do? Take the office off me? They can't take Christmas off me. They can't take my... What are they going to do? What are they going to...
Right.
The idea is when I've gone through what I've been, you become the person I am, you don't care. You know, you try to...
I feel the same way.
You know, nothing scares you. You're either going to come around and beat you up. Come on round. Come on, like what? You know, I'm going to sue you. I don't care. I don't care. I mean, nobody has, but I don't care. And I was 63 a few months ago, and I really don't care now. You know, because you'll say in the past, don't you? Well, he said, well, it doesn't bother me. And he does. It's human nature. Part of the brain picks it up in the subconscious, and it hurts. Words hurt. So that stupid rhyme, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is totally wrong. Because it does. It really does hurt.
Yeah.
But I got to a position 4 or 5 years ago, then I stopped caring. I stopped caring about what you taught me, because it's really none of your business. And I did. I thought on podcast, I've got to tell you this. I never shared this. I got on a podcast about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and the guy was like kind of trying to goad me. And the first question, live. Yeah, to about 500,000 people live. He said, so I've seen like loads of comments on Google, you know, bad reports. How do you deal with that? And it freed me for a second. And I went, how do I deal with you? How do? Well, you know, I've seen this and I've seen that. I said, I've apparently 4 comments on Google, and the rest are amazing. And secondly, I run a multi-million-dollar business. I personally get paid $3 million a year. I don't give a shit what anybody thinks of me. Why would you say that question? He's like, what are you going to do? I don't care. You know, I've been through, I fought so hard to be where I am. When I was in America, the medical fraternity tried to blacklist me. A few years in, they stripped me of my psychology license because they said I was following protocol. I got it back 6 or 7 months later. Everybody around me, every treatment center, every terrible you're going to do, you're killing people, you're doing that. And all of a sudden, that success rate started to rise. And it started to rise, and it started to rise. Now, listen to this, guys. We have a 98% success rate. If you relapse after leaving us while still following our program, we're the only company in the world, and I will refund your money if that happens. Again, we're not 20 or 30 patients in. We're 8,500 patients in. Because we do what we love, because we love what we do. So my streets, my education, 2 different things. My education and my 2 PhDs, masters, bachelors, and other stuff that I did as well, doesn't really mean a lot to me in this industry. What means a lot is that I lived on the streets. What means a lot is I survived this. What means a lot is everything that you come at me at. Well, you've never lost your children, check. You've never stabbed your check. You've never been beaten almost to death, check. I've got them all checked. And I know that's what God wanted me to do. He wanted all them boxes checked. And I used to walk in AA, oh, here's the God guy. you know, I'd never say it to my face, but you could hear it and you could tell by the way it was. I carried on, carried on. I took a lot of beatings when I come over psychologically. Nobody would ever, you know, say, you know, I said on a few occasions, step outside and we'll sort this out. It's like, oh, no, no, you know, but God kept me safe and God kept me with this thing. So I know you're waiting for this, guys. How did I get off the streets? Well, this is crazy. The first bit is crazy.
This is my favorite story of all time. I love it. I'm so excited.
I would tell this, as you know, for years and years. But I one night I was down in the factories and the offices, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, nobody there, no human beings in sight. It's pouring down. This is after my second death on the streets. A couple of weeks after that, I dropped down to my hands and knees and I looked up to the sky as an atheist because my priest molested me. So the religion wasn't a deal. I'm still not religious. I have a spiritual path. I don't go to church. I don't read the Bible. But I dropped down to my hands and knees and I looked up to the sky with the rain pouring. And I said, if there's a God up there, I can't do this on my own anymore. But 30 seconds later, this guy went around the corner, little Bible in his hand, missed his last bus home from Bible study. He took a shortcut he'd never taken before to his house because he's never walked. He's always got the bus. Then he came up on me and he said, hey, you okay? And I said, no, I'm dying. I've got nothing done. And he happened to be a recovering alcoholic, he called himself, and a Christian. And he took me back to his house and he let me bathe, change. He got some clothes for me. And he said, you can stay for as long as you want, Rob, but the only thing you got to do is come to AA meetings with me. Well, I hated them meetings because they were all war stories and, you know, bragging how much you could drink and I'm still miserable and I'm 50 years sober and I had this bad day. Hated them guys. I didn't want that kind of deal, but I went because it was a drive there. 30 minutes into it, 20 minutes, and this guy said, my name's John, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My ears pricked up and I looked at Derek and I said, what did he just say? Derek said, he said he was a recovered alcoholic. He can't recover. He's talking bullshit. And I listened to that guy. And every single crazy thing he said, he opened the page of the big book and pointed at. People were like, wow, oh my God. So anyway, when we finished, I walked over and said, hey, John, will you sponsor me? And he said, no. And just before the world opened up and swallowed me, because that walk of about 10 yards felt like the Sahara Desert to ask for help, you know. He said, but I will be a spiritual advisor for 12 weeks. So what do I have to do? Get yourself a dictionary, get yourself a big book. And I'm like, I don't need a dictionary. I went to Oxford. Bring yourself a dictionary and a big book. That's all he said. Okay. So I think I stole the dictionary. Well, sure. Went to that man's house, left Derek's left Derek's at 6, got there for 7, left at 8, got back at 9. That was my Wednesday evening for 12 weeks. The only thing I found, I was fascinated what he's telling me I'm a prophet, and then all this crazy stuff. And we got through the 12 steps, and we got through trauma, we got through, you know, the psychology of it, and way back when nobody knew what it was. And the last night I was there, I thanked him profusely because the compulsion had gone. And, you know, things were amazing. And he said, your life will change from tomorrow. And I said, trying to be smart, well, I'm in Derek's basement on the blob mattress. So don't think you're right there, John, but thank you so much for what you did. The next day, I cleaned the house. That's what I do while Derek's at work. And he came home at lunchtime. What are you doing over lunchtime? And he said, the guy that sweeps the factory floor has just resigned. Do you want his part-time job? I didn't think of John. I said, oh, my God, yeah. Next that week, you turned into a full-time job. I was working with people in and outside of AA, doing book studies, getting people well, just working with people. That anybody would listen, I was telling them about this book and how the streams of 50 God words, 130 messages, 122 promises, and, you know, stuff like that, and 132 must words. And that full-time job, and I got my first paycheck. And I went to the gas station, and I bought John a little teddy bear and a card. And I wrote on the card, thank you, John, for introducing me to God, because he, capital H, has took the compulsion away to drink. And I walked back to Derek's, man. I walked back to John's, and I was so excited, man. I went to get there and say, look how well I've done, John. You were right all along. I'm sorry I doubted you. But when I got there, I knocked on the doors, the curtains look a bit dirty. I knocked on the door, and there's no answer. You know? So I was knocking that hard that the woman on the right hand of the pond comes out and she says, can I help you? I said, yeah, where's John? Has he moved somewhere or something? He said, John who? I said, John, your neighbor. And she went, oh, I don't know. I've only been here for like 3 or 4 months. I've never seen a neighbor, sorry. She closed the door. So I went on to the left and I banged on the door. And this big guy come to the door. What do you want? I said, hey, man, where's John moved to? Relocated, John. John who? John, the next door neighbor. John, what's wrong with you? John, you're wasting my time. I said, not wasting your time. I came here for 12 weeks. He went on to tell me that that apartment was Derek's. And if you was to open the door, you'd walk in and fall down to the apartment below because there's no floors in that apartment. So I'm thinking he's crazy or drunk. Went back to the meter that met him in like 4 or 5 months ago. I don't know how long. When I walk in, the chair went, Robert, oh my God, you're back. And I'm like, thank goodness for that. I said, yes, you recognize me. Went, oh yeah, recognize you. I said, does John still come here? And he said, John who? And I said, John, and I'm explaining that I'm over in the coffee machine and I'm asking him to sponsor me. And he said, he'd be my spiritual advisor. And he said, Rob, you and you're over near the coffee machine speaking to yourself. I've never found that man. And when I got wealthy, I put the best private detectives in Manchester on. I never found him, but what he taught me is what I do today and will continue to do. It's crazy, but people are getting well. We're doing what we were put on this earth to do.
It kind of makes me want to cry a little every time I hear that story because, I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. I'm spiritual and I 100% believe it. And it's incredible.
Yeah. You know, as you know, I'll tell a story for about, I want to say 15 years, 10 years. I mean, my memory in the past is terrible, times and places. But a long time until I told the guy when I first came out, I couldn't drive or nothing, but he used to take me with a crew, you know, 6 or 7 other young guys. I come out rough speak and we used to travel all over flipping Dallas and, you know, and I told him and a few nights later I was speaking, he said, tell the John, he stood up, said, tell us John's story. And I told it really embarrassingly as if people were going to mock me and I was prepared for someone to shout out, you're an idiot or something. But I was welcome so much. And since that day, people have come up, oh my God, I've been through a seminar. Can I tell you about it? I'm like, yeah, please do. You. So yeah, it's been an amazing journey so far.
So tell me, after you, you know, had this spiritual advisor who has now disappeared off the face of the earth completely, and you were going to these meetings, What was next?
I was doing a meeting every night, not because of the 1990. That's not an AA thing. It's kind of a judge and acron thing. So there's a lot of stuff you hear in rooms and other places that are not true. And there's a lot of stuff you hear about alcoholism and addiction that's not true. But people want you taking pills, the food keeps us sick, da-da-da, the pharmaceutical company, all that stuff. So I got a little job. And then I got my license back and I was seeing people at my house, you know, like a little house office in this apartment that Derek got me. And when the internet first came out, these little chat boxes, chat rooms, I was on at Christian Watts and this girl named Sue kept talking to me and was back and forth and she told me her story and I told her mine. And we chatted every day. And one day she said, hey, the pastor in our church, huge church and just outside Dallas, he wants you to come over and you work with the youth ministry. So I was Plano at the time and there's a huge crack cocaine problem with the affluent in Plano. He was like, oh my God. Tried to act cool. Oh my God, yes. So they paid for me to come here. They bought my airline tickets. The girl at Sue, she picked me up and I stayed with her, beautiful lady. And this was 3 months. So they sent all the tickets over and everything was amazing. And about 7 to 10 days before, maybe 9 days, I got my passport and it was expired by about a week. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I was crushed. So I went down to a passport agency, I got my money, I'm going to expedite it and put it through. And I said, how long does it take? It's 4 to 6 weeks. What if I expedite it? 3 to 4 weeks. I said, no. Like, I need it next week. I need, like, 8 days' time. I mean, I'm so sorry. It's not going to happen. So don't expedite it. You're wasting your money. It's not going to be here for them. Just put it through as normal. 4 to 6 weeks over here. So I went back out, and I was so embarrassed and cried and cried because I couldn't come. And I was going to wait till the day before. I was going to tell him a lie. I was going to tell him I'd gone down with flu or something, or taken it to hospital or whatever. And 2 days before I was supposed to fly, there was a knock on the door. Now, here's the interesting plot. I lived in an apartment at that time on the second floor. There's a mailbox downstairs that everybody used. Nobody come, the postman, we call them, or their mailman, don't come to the door. They just put it through the mailbox. He came, he knocked on the door. I'm like, who tells that? Opened, it was a postman, mailman. And he gave me this package and even my passport. And it was done in about 6 days. So that was my first huge miracle and huge flag to go, oh my God, I was meant to be here. Then we flew over, I flew over here, 3 weeks worth of clothes and money. And when I landed, we was on the tarmac back then. We was on this plane, it's called the tarmac there into a tunnel. But as soon as my foot hit the floor, I thought to myself, I'm never going back again. I just had this strong feeling that this is where it was all meant to be. And for some crazy reason, so didn't think of it though, started to work. And then Sue had been employed for a couple of months, applied for this job, this architect doing the office stuff for her. And she had an interview. So she says, why don't you drive us? Because I was driving by then on my, you know, English license. So I drove her there, and, you know, it's amazing. I drove for the first time, did well. And she goes in. She's in there for about 6 minutes and she comes out. Like, she can get a job. This is what she said. He wants to see you. I'm like, what? He wants to see you. I can't see him. I'm in a t-shirt. I can't see. He wants to see you. That's all he keeps saying. Oh my God. I went in. I was so, he obviously wanted to see what a partner was like. And I came in and this is what she's, and I've never shared this before. So this is an exclusive. You could just come to me right now. And when I come in, he said, we've been waiting for you. And I was out of the car. I mean, no, we've been waiting for you for years. And I'm like, okay, well, Sue, I'm thinking you can't take this job. This guy's a freaking idiot. He's deranged or something. So I said, he went to tell me, blah, 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 blah. Now, when I was in England, John often talks about Isaiah 61, which was to help the sick and bring great news to the families, or something like that. And he kept telling me, Isaiah 61, you're the boy, Isaiah 61. Because that's what I did, really. And he was in there talking, and he said, listen, you need to come to our group. And when he said that, he turned around and said, oh, by the way, so you got the job start Monday. And he focused back on me. He said, you got to come, you got to speak, we've been waiting for you. And I'm still thinking it's weird. And I guess up, we shook hands. Sue's all happy because she got the job. And we walked towards the door, and I turned around and I said, by the way, what's the group called? And he said, I swear to God, he said, we call ourselves on Isaiah 61. And from there, my life took off.
Amazing. And do you still, so what do you do today for your recovery? Are you still active at 12-step meetings?
I am not.
Do you still do any of those things?
Yeah, I stopped going about just over a year ago. The big book is the best piece of literature ever written, the first 164. Pertaining to recovery. I use that today. I use it in my personal life. I use it in business life. I don't go to the meetings because the meetings where I live, just too many personalities trying to, you know, get. So I stopped going. I have my routine. I have a strong spiritual connection. I looked after myself. I've just lost, as of yesterday, it was 157 pounds that I've lost. So I'm eating right. I'm training every day. I'm just doing right. So that's me personally. Helping people across the board, like we have the Neuro Hill conference, we have the Neuro Realty conference where we teach entrepreneurs to earn $1 million in the first year, otherwise we must pay you the million. We have outrageous claims that we use because we know we're doing it right. But neuroscience is the king, I'm telling you. We found out about the neuroscience and what childhood trauma really is and what addiction and how people really are. People walk around about 60 to 75% of their capability and capacity. So we take it to 100. I mean, we use things like 9D therapy, breath work. We use NLP. We use somatic experience. We use psychology. We use behavioral science. We use, you know, all these tools that we use on this 90-day, every single day. It's an hour a day for 90 days to get you back. And we start your business off, or we get you back into work, and we work with the families, and it's just amazing.
I love that.
Also, it'd be amazing.
Well, you know, because of you, I am now also a 9D breathwork facilitator.
No.
Because I had the experience in your home, and it was transformative. And I've been doing breath works for over 3 years with a private coach. But this was, you know, it's funny because she said to me, she goes, "You never cry with me. I can't believe you're telling me that you cried at some stranger's home right. in Texas." I was like, I was sobbing in your living room, you know, and it was an incredible experience. So I'm so grateful to you for bringing that into my life. You know, that and the breath you taught me in the morning, like the breathing in and out 20 times, you know, just those things were so helpful. And the way you speak is so compelling and really you're very motivating, you know. It's like, oh my God. And if and I've had a good life, but I you know, it got to a point where alcohol was the only thing my brain consumed. Yeah. Right. I wasn't eating. I needed a blood transfusion and detox. I was really far gone. And I'm really lucky that I had the opportunity and the intervention and all of that, but I'm with you, you know, like there's very little I fear. And of course fears come up for me. And like once in a while I'll be like, oh, you know, like financially, will everything be okay or whatever? And it's normal. No matter how much money I have in my bank account, these stupid fears sometimes come up and I just have to like be like, duh, you know, everything has always worked out. When has it not worked out?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I want to move on to some questions now, just because I find you so interesting. So the first question I kind of have is like, you talked a little bit about during your conference about neuroplasticity. And you talked about kind of retraining your brain after addiction. So I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind, if you're okay with that.
100%. It's all about patterns. It's all about patterns. Now, here's the interesting part. 10 years ago, the medical fraternity were very excited when they find out that changing neural pathways and changing patterns within the brain is possible. And they tagged it as neuroplasticity, which is amazing. What a lot of them didn't know on that board was 1938, when the two guys wrote that book, they said that it's vital, necessary to life, it's vital, that you have, you know, this psychic change, okay, and a spiritual awakening, okay? That's what he said. So the psychic change is rebuilding patterns in the brain and redirecting neural pathways. How did they know? What? So that was one of them. So, and then the spiritual. So the more we go into the mind, subconscious, conscious, subconscious wakes up every morning, wants to kill you, and go like an accident. Yeah, once we knew all about that, we found out this, and there's a lot of work, and it goes into depth, and I'm willing to go there if you want me to, but when you have the psychic change, the changing our pathways, and when your energy inside your brain, the mind, energy, can't feel it, touch it, the mind over, the brain is matter, mind over matter, connects with another energy or power, your DNA changes. That was our discovery. It was phenomenal. So then you've got to look at what else. See, I was never happy going, you're an alcoholic, you know, go to the doctors, go to AA, go to treatment. Then why? Well, you just drink too much alcohol. If I was me and you was to be in Florida, I was taking you out to the streets and ask 20 people, what is alcoholism? Everybody would say someone who drinks too much alcohol. That's not true. That's not true. And yet we're brainwashed. If I could just stop drinking, well, guess what? It's 1% to do with it. What about the other 99% that's torturing you? You know, what about parts of the brain that are set to kill you? And I'm telling you to drink alcohol, not food or water. What about that? So that's why we went into depth of what is neuroplasticity. How can we change the brain permanently? And this is why we do 1 hour a day. If repetition strengthens, confirms. So that part of the brain is the basal ganglia. You know, let's say a pilot needs 20,000 hours in the air before he can fly a commercial jet. It's doing the same thing over and over and over. That becomes a pattern, like driving a car. First time you get in, you're like, oh my God, it's so big. Oh my God. And after a couple of months, you pass your test. You can reverse down the driveway, waving at mom, speaking to the girlfriend, texting, listening to music, and saying hi to the neighbor at the same time without even thinking. That's called the basal ganglia, that part that, imagine a clock face. just goes round and round with everything that we do and learn. So if I drove a car once and went to drive back 20 years later, I'm not going to be able to do it. It's got to be in the basal ganglia that gets imprinted in the brain, becomes a working part of the brain. That's how I can do that. With the alcoholic, the basal ganglia is at default. So again, imagine a clock face. 10 after, we go on a bender. 20 after, we try to come around. You know, we get the wife back. 1:30, we get the kids back. 22, we get that job we always wanted. At that 10 to the hour, you will sell sandwich. Because the neural pathways in your head are routed to default, which is self-sabotaging. It's not the outcome. For you, it is. For me, it is. Might be drugs, kicks, food, sex, whatever, porn, whatever it is. But that needs to be repaired, and that's about patterns. So I often say to people, do you have any patterns? No, I don't know. Look, I don't know when it is, but have you ever been to the seaside or to a concert with a bunch of people on the bus? You all go down there, you're singing, you get there, you have a few drinks, you have a great time. You get back on the bus, which seat do you sit in? Usually the one you've traveled there in. And people go, oh my God, I do that, I do. It's like they're the patterns that are pretty good and funny. But what happens with childhood trauma, we get patterns that are definitely not only killers, we're going to take people with us. And unless them change. So wake up in the morning. One of the reasons why nobody's ever woke up laughing is lack of oxygen. So when I say this, take this seriously. The presence of oxygen equals the lack of disease. Every disease in the human body created, cancers, growths, heart attack, whatever it is, grows or starts to grow in a hypoxic area of the body. So we only breathe 45 to 65% of our lung capacity. The reason why you feel so good going to the gym is not the exercise, it's this in between sets. So the oxygen. So the subconscious brain wakes us up in the morning. The subconscious brain thrives where there's no oxygen or little oxygen. So during our sleep pattern, normal circadian rhythm sleep pattern, 2 and 5 o'clock in the morning is usually when the body is at its weakest. The breath is slow. The building is starting. The repair of the body as a whole is starting, whether it be a cut or brain or whatever it's repairing. You wake up in the morning, hardly any oxygen. So the subconscious brain wakes us up. Oh my God, look at this, stub my toe. It's blowing outside, blah, 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 all that stuff. It's the guy that's going to kill you eventually. Okay? That's the guy that nothing ever goes right for me. You know, I never win this. I never do that. I know I'm not going to, you know, get that job. Well, the problem is, there's no fucking problem. Stop saying that. But we get up and you do your 20 exotic breaths in. Exaggerated breaths. Not just... really go to town about what happens is this. Yeah. And the conscious brain takes over. Now, this guy is back here somewhere, okay? This guy is going to win. This guy is going to complete. This guy is the best father, the best husband, the best worker, the best entrepreneur, the best golfer. He's going out to win every single day. He's learning new things. He's going. He's loving life, and his life seems amazing. But you know, when he goes to bed, who wakes him up in the morning? This guy. And that's why the repetition, strength, and confirms comes from, is you have to get rid of that subconscious brain, because what will happen is when the prefrontal cortex goes, give me an answer. That's what his main job is. It needs an answer to your problem straight away. He needs it now, and he goes into the brain and get it. When the patterns are self-sabotaging, okay, that which means that 90% are self-sabotaging, what happens is it goes straight to the subconscious brain and it takes the answer from the subconscious brain, which is usually negative. I can't do it. It's a waste of time. If you're that guy, I want to apologize to you. Somebody's popped out there. Babies are born with two fears. The fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. The rest are man-made. Wait till your father gets home. If you don't pass that exam, you better bring in more money to this. Fear does not exist. It really doesn't exist. Okay? So I want to ask yourself this question. If that, what we're talking about, is true, and 300 neural pathways-ish die daily, which they do, what are you replacing then 300 neural pathways with? Are you replacing with the conscious brain that's up and going, or are you living here in childhood trauma? So you can't really do, I almost got that job. I almost did this. Are you living from that guy? Because if you're cramming them, that 300 neural pathways with positive stuff on a daily basis, you're going to get better and better and better. That's what you're going to get. People don't know this, so they don't do it. Patterns, you want to start a pattern from tomorrow morning, guys? do the 20 exaggerated breaths, go into the bathroom. If you brush your teeth with the right hand, I want you to brush a week with the left, a week with the right, a week with the left, and a week with the right. Alternate. When you start that, I want you to look yourself in the mirror. Now, this is very important, again, going back to the psychology of the brain. If you stand close to the mirror, you'll see all your blemishes. So women putting makeup on or guys shaving, we think that the public sees us like this, where we can see our blemishes. When's the last time you met in the office? Hey, Jimmy, how you doing? Nice to see you. We don't do that. But when you stand, it's a very, very good optical illusion. When you stand 6 feet away from the mirror, all your blemishes disappear. That's a confidence booster right there. I love you 10 times. You can't feel anything. It's going to seem stupid. You feel embarrassed doing it. You are stuffing that subconscious brain and conscious brain with good stuff. So that's like 20 of them neuropathways is good stuff. And it's a numbers game. You know, if you have 80% self-sabotaging, which the childhood trauma and everything like that, 20% good, the more good stuff you push in, the more healthy neural pathways we start restoring, then obviously you're going to get a balance like this, where your conscious brain with the neural pathways are healthy and conscious and ready to go for the right decision based on your circumstances. And the bad neural pathways and the subconscious brain is going to be put at the back over here. That's living in the now. See, the law of attraction is like this, guys. People think, oh, law of attraction, yeah, I'm going to attract what I think, you know, I'm going to attract what... No, guys, you're looking at it the wrong way. That's not the law of attraction. Okay, so let me put it in layman's terms. You're watching cable tonight. You have a show you want to watch. Bam, bam, channel 143. Bam, 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 and you're on. That's yours. Now, remember, at the same time you're watching that program that you like, that you love and laugh and it's tearful. While you're watching that, there's 2,000 channels flying around you. So on your cable box, let's say there's 150 channels that you could be watching, but you're watching channel 143, okay? But there's all these other channels that you're aware of, obviously, but your focus is on channel 143 because the program that you want to watch, that's the law of attraction. Now, I want that 143, so I'm staying on there despite hundreds and odds, you know, channels around me. Now, give that remote control over to your toddler or your young kid, and he will start changing them channels. And all of a sudden, you've got this channel, this channel, this channel, this channel, this channel, and the scattered channels you can't. All of a sudden, your show, your 143 channel that you was concentrating on to make it a best show, it's gone. That's what we do in life. You concentrate on become, let's say, a millionaire. But please, you've got to believe me. Oh. Does not, but let's say it's the easiest one to describe. You're constant, but there's all these things going on around you. Like this has happened, your sister's done this. Then it's all cut out the noise. Stop the noise around you and concentrate on channel 143. And that 143 will be sat in your brain and you'll start acting that way. You'll start quoting the lines from that comedy at work. You know, because you take on that channel 143, it's the same thing, that's the law of attraction. It's the same thing with life. Cut the noise out. You know it's there, but you don't need to look at that right now. You need to concentrate and focus that your dream 100% could come true. Well, I cannot be president of the United States, they used to say to me. Let's forget the political views for a second, man. Just forget about it. I'm not interested in politics. But we had a business of running the country for 4 years. With no political experience whatsoever. Don't dare tell me you can't live your dream. It's just not true. Somebody's put that there. Find out who it is and get rid of those. Don't stand for anybody speaking down. Don't stand for anybody that's not lifting you up. And watch for these guys. Hey, Rob, you're not going to get that job. No, I'm joking. He needs to go. Your circle needs to be three friends around you. Because you can bet in your family and circle right now there's at least one person that wants you to fail. That's the guy that's not clapping when you win something. Watch out for them guys. Then get rid of them. Don't even think about it. Because everything is possible. And that's why we guarantee our work. You know, you're not going to come and see us for like, oh, I've been seeing my therapist for like 2 years. When do you think it was going to work? I've been taking depression meds now for 20 years. When do you think they were going to kick in? Stop following these false, pretense liars around you. But if you do this, this will happen. You'll never recover. You'll always be an alcoholic. I don't tag myself as an alcoholic. I've recovered. I am an ex-problem drinker. Recovered means the game wants health. Well, I'm not sick anymore. with the alcohol and state of mind. Well, I'm not insane. I don't go around stabbing my current wife three times. Recover, yeah, use that. Stop telling yourself, oh, I'm an alcoholic. Well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim, an alcoholic. You're convincing your brain that you one day you're going to relapse.
And that's so funny because my boyfriend is not an alcoholic or a recovering alcoholic, never was. And he asks me that. He goes, why do you still say you're an alcoholic? It's very confusing to me. And I say to him, I go, and I don't go to AA as much as I used to. And I say to him, oh, well, you know, in AA, they want you to always remember that you are so that you don't go back to your old, you know, your old devices. But his argument is, yeah, but they aren't you reinforcing this belief that you are an alcoholic? And I always say, yeah, you're right, you know? And you know, what you said earlier, there's so many things they say in AA that's like not true. I agree with that, you know? And then there's so many things that they say that is so true and is so interesting, you know? And you have to take it all, I think, with a grain of salt type of thing. But I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said that.
Well, the other thing you've got to look at is what, you know, the big book is the main purpose. The Alcoholics Anonymous is the book. We are the fellowship of the book. People misquote the book. People don't read the book. That if I asked you now, how long you been in AA? A rough idea. 10 years? 15 years? You personally?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, eight.
Eight. So you've been in AA. What does step one say?
We're all powerless. I'm an alcoholic and... my life is unmanageable.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Powerless. Powerless over alcohol.
See? We're all powerless. Yeah. Easy. Yeah. That's not what he says.
Yeah.
That's not what the writers of that book, that's not what they're saying. The sentence goes, step one is we admitted we were powerless. There's no apostrophe there. People don't know that because they're taking the book and they're rearranging it again. Is that? You know, don't mention Jesus Christ in AA meetings. Oh, really? 11 page, second word. Oh, well, you can't fully recover. Oh, really? 17 times it mentions recover. On 11 occasions, it mentions recover. And the only two times to the wives and to the employers does it mention recovering. Okay? So I got sober in AA, okay? But the more meetings I went on and the more these idiots around you, and probably 80% of any meeting anywhere is not real alcoholics. They're the guys that are lonely. The guys that have been sent there. They want a young girl to be married. You're not. When you take the first drink, can you stop? Oh, I went to AA, I'm 50 years sober from the day I want. No, you're not the real deal. Well, you can't say that. I don't give a shit what you say. I'm telling you from my experience around the world of millions of AA meetings and stuff that I've done for almost 25 years traveling around the world. And I tell you right now that 80% of people in that room are not the real deal. Judges said them.
I've heard that before too. Actually, that
you gotta be careful.
A lot of people.
You gotta be careful what you're listening to. Now, if you find a meeting that's straight in the big book and concentrate in the, not as Bill sees it, as Bob sees it, called the AA book, you will get well. But if you start listening to, you know, one of my first sponsors, well, we're going to do a step a month, and you know, that's what my sponsor taught me. Well, listen, guess what? You're not an alcoholic, so you can do that. I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and I can't go a step a month. So what happens is I keep relapsing, Mr. Sponsor, and I think it's me that doesn't fit in, when really it's you. And the sponsor, when you relapse, goes, well, you know, he wasn't ready. I want to punch you in the face. What do you mean he wasn't ready? You don't have the equipment or the experience to help him get ready. You don't have it. It's your responsibility when he comes in to get him into that book. The steps are done in 2 days. After you get a full knowledge of your condition, it's there in the book. One, next we go on immediately. Then after step five, go home. Nobody does that. That's why the success rate has gone down from 1990 at Akron to less than 3% a day. So you just
careful. One of my current sponsees, I'm taking through back to basics, which is the way they used to do it, which was steps 1, 2, 3, the first meeting, steps 4, 5, 6, 7, I think, you know, I don't know by heart, but I'm reading through it with her. And, you know, she's the type of, she's tried this 8 times. She's been through the big book. She's done. No time to waste. Like I told her, I'm like, let's do this. There's no time. I went through it quickly. Let's go through it quickly.
Like 2 days.
But
Johnson me in 2 days, I was done. We had to read the book first to get a full knowledge of my condition. That took about 2 weeks. But in the meantime, he was in the book, was getting, you know, looking at the book. And then 2 days, it's done. Now, we start writing in, guys. What does he know? That ass, like enough. Hey, I'm not. I got sober in an A. I think it's amazing. Any A, any church, anything that gets you sober and clean is brilliant. What I'm saying is there's more to it, and there's more neuroscience to add to what they had. That's all. I love AA, you know, but we are brainwashed into these thought patterns that carry on. Oh, you can't date in the first year. Where does that say that in the book? Well, you can't make a decision. Where does it say that in the book? Never says you can't make a major decision. Like, well, I'm not to. Oh, listen, you need to get on a plane tomorrow and you need to go over there and make amends. And you need to tell him I'm sorry. It never says that in the book. There's a certain, I regret. It used the word regret, not sorry. The can't be seen. There's loads of stuff. I used to teach the big books for years and years, you know, but it's amazing. If you go to a shit meeting with that book and you stay in that book and talk for a minute, you're going to get well. 100%.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. 100%. But just be careful that you take an advice on. Like life, look at the source. If I get somebody 100%. On negative. By the way, guys, anybody that's doing as good as you or better will never make a negative comment about me. Never. It's the guys that are still down there that want to make themselves look big. You know, Rob Kelly's not really from England, didn't go to college. He's not really a doctor. He's not really living here. He's not really. Keep going, man. You know, if that makes you feel good, keep going. But you look at where I am in life, look where you are in life. Because I know this thing with being spiritual, God. When I get to heaven, because I believe there's a heaven. When I get taken in front of God, you know what he's not going to ask me? How much was that car you were driving? How big was that house? Look at that watch you have on that solid gold Rolex. What? How much did that? He's going to ask me one thing. How many people did you help? That's what I was going to ask. So I don't give a shit about anything. I have toys because I can afford them cars. I have things. I have stupid 60 grand watches and it's investments. I do what I do because my life is balanced and I know. And the reason why I tell you that, guys, is that you can do this if you stop flicking cable channels and concentrate on the real law of attraction. It's all channel 143 is going to be there till the day you die. Why are you flicking around and, you know, watching this channel there when your purpose is channel 143? And you're not going to believe this, but that channel thing I've just thought about right now, it came into my head. It's like the law of attraction is that, you know?
Yeah. So I want to give you the opportunity to talk about some of the current work you're doing. I know you have a coaching course. So talk to us. Tell us about what you're doing currently. I love your story. I thank you so much for sharing everything. I mean, you're incredible. Such a wealth of knowledge and great information. And tell me what you're up to.
So today the Rob Kelly Group, a step away from Rob Kelly Recovery Group, because now we deal with all likes of people with childhood trauma and stuff, and depression and just life in general. So we do that. That's kind of my main job. I have a restaurant next to my offices. It's a British restaurant, a full-blown restaurant. I brought my sister over here to help me run it. So her and her husband, both from Manchester, run it. We have most of the staff are from England. So we do English dishes, we cater, we do anything that you want, parties, Harry Potter themes, stuff like that. So that's going on. I have a security company which is doing monitoring, live monitoring and access in and out and stuff like that to really exclusive, stock important buildings like the FBI buildings and stuff like that. We make sure they get in and out, you know, and they use the best technology in the world. We have the NeuroHero Conference that we do twice a year, myself and Adam Jablin. And then we have the Neuro Realty Conference, which I do with Donna. And then I have my public speaking. And just started back on TV again. So, you know, I do lots of things, So there's something I want to say while we're on the, you know, what you're doing. So I've got a book out there and it's called Daddy, Daddy, Please Stop Drinking. And of course,
here it is.
Yeah. So stay there. Well, I want to take a photograph of that. Stay there a minute. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But listen, guys, if you
and we'll put this in the show notes. We'll put a link to buy the book in the show notes and everything.
Here's the book. That it's on Amazon for like $9, $10, I don't know. If you want a copy of that book and you can't afford a copy of that book, you message me or message the show. I will sign that book and I will mail it out. I'll pay for everything and I'll send you a free copy. Won't cost you a dime. Signed by me. The only condition I ask is that you pass it on to somebody else when you finish.
I did buy my book, but I also got your signature. Because I got it at the Neuro Conference when I was there.
That's,
which,
you know,
if,
that was a beautiful, that was the back at the house, you know, that was a one-off. Someone said, should we go back to the house? And I'm like, well, we've never had anybody at the house. We don't do that. We don't kind of make business with pleasure. But I told Adam, I was like, oh yeah, we've got to go. And then you come along, the third person to agree with it. And then we had like 20 people back at the house going through 90. It's just amazing. It was amazing. It really was.
Next time you come,
you've got to stay with us. Janet insisted.
Okay,
Janet kept talking to me for like 2 months after.
I love Janet.
She's an amazing girl. We need to hang out with her. She's just fantastic, you know.
Well, I'm waiting for you guys. The apartment's here, and I live on the beach, so you have no excuses. I mean, listen.
Where do you live? Just the area.
Highland Beach.
Where is that? Because we
that's in Boca.
Boca. Yeah, yeah. We have a patient in Naples that we go every
three. No, I'm on the other side.
Well, I'm going to have to come over there and meet Adam, meet you again. It's been too long before I've been over there, so we'll make sure.
I'll text Janet, and
yeah.
I will remind her.
You know what the deal is, yeah? Don't tell me. I've got no. They'll be gone by the time we finish the show. So,
yeah. I forgot. Actually, it's so funny because I meant to text you, but I guess I texted your email. I don't know what I did, but I got it all wrong. And thank God Courtney reached out to me. So I'm really glad you were able to be here and do this with me. And I'm so excited, really. I'll let you know before it airs. And what we'll do is I'll also text Janet and get you to come out here. No excuses.
That would be absolutely awesome because that. We love both.
So, Dr. Rob, tell me, I ask this of everyone, if you could tell your younger self something, kind of give them a message, how old would you be? Like, what do you picture in your mind when I say your younger self? How old is this little Rob? And what would you say?
I want to do two if I can. The 8-year-old,
yeah.
It's going to be okay. Because I was abandoned and stuff like that. No fault of my parents. So it's going to be okay. You know, I've done my trauma work around the 8-year-old. The 12-year-old would be that you can do anything in the world. Do it now. That's it. Because people think we have time. You know, well, I'm going to do this tomorrow. You don't have time, guys. Everything we say and everything I've said on this program has been researched. It's been tested. There's been trials, clinical trials, everything. And the one thing we did with friends and family that, you know, parents or grandfather was in hospice, we were allowed to go and see him, and we asked him one or two questions. And one question that came over, and the answer was the same, is if there's one thing you regret, what would it be? And everyone says, I thought I had more time. And you don't, guys. You know, mums, waving off to kindergarten, next minute they say they're waving off to college. We don't have time. And we have a 7.3 golden rule here. And that's when a thought pattern comes, if you don't act towards that, like make a move towards that in the first 7.3 seconds, it's gone. Let me explain. Sat on the sofa tonight, big bag of chips, big can of Coke, and drinking. I turn around to Janet and go, hey, Janet, I'm thinking you go to the gym tomorrow. I ain't go to the gym tomorrow. I know it. She knows it. The dogs know it. Even the cat in the corner knows it. I'm not going. But if I put that down straight away, I walk into the bedroom, I get my gym stuff, and I put it near the door, there's a good chance of me going. So the message from that is start that business, marry that girl, buy that house, go for that job, you know, buy that car. It's like, do it now. Don't wait, because waiting is subconscious. The doing is conscious. When we live in the now, the conscious part, nothing is impossible. Nothing.
Thank you. I love that. Anything else you feel like you may have missed that you want to talk about?
Let's talk about the robkellyfoundation.org is something we started about a month ago. And we like to bring things differently. We want an end result. We want a guarantee at the end. That's why our company has been so successful. The Rob Kelly Foundation is to give back to society, to those who need help. And it's not just alcoholics addicts. It's across, you know, you have to fill paperwork in. You have to go through a vetting period, which is very short, a few hours. But let's say you give $100 to the foundation today, and that $100 goes towards a guy that needs to buy a suit to stand in front of the judge, prove to the judge he needs to see his children once a week. Okay. So you've bought that $100 bought in the grocery. Okay. When he gets his child back or when the event's over, you're going to get an email off that guy thanking you and telling you where that money you donated went to. Saves $10 or a dollar. He's going to say, with that dollar you saved, it helped me buy this suit. And you'll get that email. There's no, we're like you. Nobody gets paid in here. You know, everybody mm-hmm. does it because they love doing it. We have a CEO that runs it. He's an amazing guy, Ray Trevino. He's a number one guy.
Oh, I know Ray. I sat in front of him at your conference.
Exactly. Well, he's running the foundation. He does a great job.
Yeah, I love Ray.
Yeah. So obviously things are going, but if you can help in any way, you know, and you have a dollar or two to spare, just jump on the robkellyfoundation.org and donate that dollar, that $10, whatever it is. We'll be so, so grateful. And you'll definitely be hearing of the person that goes to.
Thank you. I love that. I will.
You never know what people are going through.
Also, I'll make sure that link. Yeah. It's true. You're right. And I will make sure that link, the robkellyfoundation.org link, gets into the show notes as well.
Let me finish real quickly on this. About helping another human being and not knowing what they're going through, because everybody's going through something. I often ask people, when everyone's asleep at nighttime and you're on your own flying, what problem do you have? What are you going through and nobody else knows about? And everybody has something. So there's a guy that walked to the Golden Gate Bridge and threw himself off and committed suicide. Mm. And the police pulled him out of the water. They found his identification. They went back to his apartment looking for the next of kin. What they found was a note on the kitchen table. And it read, I'm going to walk to the Golden Gate Bridge and throw myself off and commit suicide. Unless on the way there, somebody smiles, nods at me, says good morning. In that case, I'll stop right there, turn around, and I'll try again tomorrow. Question to you guys. How many people today have you walked by who's headed to the Golden Gate Bridge?
Thank you for that. That's really profound. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Dr. Rob. It's such a pleasure, and I hope to see you soon.